are listening to Food Trucks in Babylon, a Western Seminary podcast with Dr. Todd Miles and Dr. Patrick Schreiner. Listen as they discuss matters of faith, theology, and culture in a post-Christian world.
Hey, this is Patrick.
And this is Todd.
Well, today we have some people that are not going to be foreigners to anyone who listens to our podcast. We have Tim and John from the Bible Project.
Hey there.
So welcome, guys.
Hi.
You guys got to come up, 10 minutes from your studio?
Yeah.
Come up with us and see our studio.
So. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Thanks for being here with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
It is great to be here. I went to school on the campus of Western Seminary, but I've never been in this particular room.
This is a very special room.
This is very, it's like in the upper floor of the back door.
Exactly.
Right. Anyway.
This is where the magic happens right here. Yeah.
And Tim, you've been teaching at Western for how long?
Yeah.
You went to Western and then
I did.
Now you're teaching for
I think when I was still finishing my dissertation, I started even coming out to do summer classes, adjunct. I don't know. I guess that's 10 years.
10 years.
I can't believe that. But that's true.
Nice. Yeah.
What years were you a student here?
From 2000 to 2001. Okay. 2000. No, no, excuse me. From 2001 to 2003.
Okay. The exact years I wasn't here.
Yeah, that's right. Because we didn't overlap. But I remember your name coming up because when the interviews process began.
Right, I'm terrible at those years in terms of when I was in school because it never ends, it feels like.
It's just totally.
And John, when was the first Bible Project video released?
2014.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That matches with at least my memory, which is good because my memory is not always very good. But I came here in 2014.
Oh, did
and
you?
Here's my story about your first video.
Okay.
So I came here in 2014, started teaching. I saw the first video, Heaven and Earth, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that the first video?
Good memory.
And I did my dissertation actually on kind of that theme.
Yes, you did.
And I was very upset and very happy. You all summarized my whole dissertation in like 5 minutes. Yeah. So I would like explain it in Matthew, and like spatial kingdom stuff.
Uh-huh.
And people after my class would be like, so it's basically the Bible Project video? And I'm like, yeah, thanks guys. And I was like cursing your names. No, just kidding. No, it's really helpful.
That's but, right. And they gave you a PhD for it.
That's right.
They did. Not, yeah, not for the
I
video.
I didn't get one. Hey, Southern might give you a PhD for that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
If anyone wants to, I'll take one.
Yeah. And so maybe, I mean, we want to get into kind of the topic we're going to go over, but can you just tell me why you did that video first? Was there any reason that one came first? Because I spent so much time in kind of that theme as well that I thought it was so neat that you all started there. Mm-hmm. But is there a reason you all started there?
Yeah.
Do you remember?
I do remember. So when we talked about doing this project, I wanted to just make theology videos and thought it'd be fun to do with Tim because I love having conversations about the Bible with Tim. And when we started talking about this and Tim was like, yeah, I'm in, let's do this. Then he brought a spreadsheet of like 100 videos, like already like, these are the ones I want to make. And most of those were just
books of the Bible.
Books of the Bible.
66.
We'll do one on Genesis. We'll do one on Exodus. But then there was 20 to 25, what you call themes. Mm-hmm. And then you organize the themes based off of what book it would be good to then also develop that theme or to think about that theme. So Heaven and Earth was connected to Genesis.
Not Matthew. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, yeah.
Maybe both.
But yeah, could.
No, it's connected.
Yeah, so that was all the thought that went into it was that would be good.
And I think you had built up a long list of questions about the cosmology of the Bible and the biblical world and heaven and earth and hell and how those all relate.
It's a very visual theme too.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you guys are making everything visual, but
we didn't have a fixed process yet for how we go about writing and making the videos. So we talked for a very long time.
Right.
Weeks and weeks and weeks.
And this was before we recorded our conversations.
Yes, that's right. So those first conversations were not recorded. That's right.
Right. So you guys have the podcast too, and how long? Sorry, now I'm going into history. We're going to get to the topic, but
maybe in 2015 at some point we started doing that.
Oh, so that was pretty early on.
It was early.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't realize that. I thought that was later on for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think maybe our third or fourth theme video is the the law. Mm-hmm. And
that's, oh, yeah, and that was our first
recording.
That's
when recorded. We turned on the microphone.
That's when we turned nice. On the microphone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
That's been a huge, I think, a huge benefit to see kind of behind the scenes and
walk a surprising, yeah, a surprising benefit for the organization because we got to have those conversations regardless.
Right.
And it wasn't actually that hard to turn on a microphone.
Yeah, just do it live.
And because we already were doing them.
You just got to cut out all the bad words.
Yeah.
Or all the ums well, and ahs.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Starts, yeah cursing yeah. me out. We always take that out. no, joking. Yeah. So, but people really love listening in. So,
yeah. Yeah. That's great. Well, today we thought we'd talk about kind of your journey of reading the Bible, both of you. Mm-hmm. And so the way we've titled it, or at least I've titled it in my mind, is kind of paradigm shifts and how you've read the Bible kind of throughout your journey of reading the Bible. So getting behind why you're looking at the Bible in this way, why you read the Bible in the way that you do. And I think it could be helpful as pastors listen in and people hear these videos are becoming so influential for how people read the Bible. And just to kind of hear the almost... is this like the apocalyptic peeling back the curtain of Tim and John?
That's right. What makes Tim and John Tim and John?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So just kind of hearing like big influences that you've had.
Yes.
Things that have kind of stuck in your mind in terms of, like this shifted everything with how I viewed the Bible. I think we can all identify at least a few moments.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, like everything clicked when I read this book or I met this person.
Yep.
And so maybe I can start with John.
Yeah,
John,
I think I should start because mine's pretty simple. I grew up in faith in a evangelical Christian church, and
large or small?
Medium.
Okay.
I think maybe 500 people.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So I just grew up with this respect for the Bible. And this desire to understand it, and then I went and studied at Multnomah University, and so that was a stream I was in, a lot of systematic theology, what ended up happening. I'm a very curious person. I'm constantly asking questions. In fact, growing up in my church, I asked too many questions. Like people, my parents, people in the church were just kind of like, slow down. I felt like there was a limit to how curious you could be as a Christian.
Uh-huh.
And so after college, I really started to just put it to the side and just decide, I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm down with Jesus, but the Bible seems like a speed bump in the whole Jesus thing. It's actually making following Jesus harder. I come with questions. I leave with more questions. I come with some anxiety. I leave with more anxiety. and I was doing that kind of not even very consciously, but at the same time, Tim and I had a relationship. We both went to undergrad together and you continued to go through school and our wives are friends and we were friends. And so we'd have conversations about the Bible and that would kind of spark this curiosity. And while having those conversations, really felt like I could ask any question and we could go deep. So on one hand, I was kind of becoming this post-Bible Christian. On the other hand, I still had, you know, a bit of a pilot light on, ready to go. So my influence has mainly been now for the last, has it been 6-7 years of the Bible Project? And before that, just our conversations has really been Tim. Okay. And I'm not really a big reader. I've just been learning from dialogue.
Yeah.
Which has been fun.
You have an insatiable appetite for content.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're constantly intaking content.
Yes. Right. I listen to a lot of stuff. Yeah, I do read.
Yeah.
But I don't have a big stack of theology books I'm trying to get through right now.
Yeah. It's true. I think it's true for a lot of people now. There's so many forms of media.
Right.
To learn.
Yeah. You don't have to read anymore. No, I'm just kidding. Don't say that.
Anyway.
It's
a great hack. I just get to let Tim do the work.
Yeah. And what about like in terms of, as you started making the Bible, the Bible book overviews, whatever you, I don't know what you call those, but
yeah,
was that how you had read before, like with literary structure being such a big part of it, or yeah.
No, and well, we both learned from Ray Lubeck at Multnomah.
Yeah, I was going to say it sounds like his fingerprints are all over this.
So intro to studying the Bible, Bible study methods, and it didn't stick for me the way I think it stuck for Tim. Mm-hmm. And so I really have learned that through our conversations. There's there's been a couple big shifts for me, and one is that I grew up in a Christian environment, culture, where the Bible is so important, so much authority, that it was not okay to talk about the human characteristic of the Bible. Mm. So if you started talking about the literary design of a book, like when we started talking about that,
or what the author intended,
what the author was intending to do, it just like made me uncomfortable, because in my tradition, the Bible's not human. The Bible is divine. And to make it human, it's going to just fall apart.
Right.
And
it introduces historical questions we can't answer, so forth and so on, maybe even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of opens this Pandora's box. And so that way of talking about the Bible was uncomfortable at first. Mm. And I had to really wrestle with that, because the truth is, and I think even anyone in my tradition would agree, that the Bible is both human and divine, and that's the orthodox view. But
has been for a long time.
It has been for a long time.
Okay, this isn't like a recent thing.
That's right. But there was just this discomfort of, and like if we could just polish off all the human fingerprints, it's safer.
Yeah.
And then you have like a pure divine word at that point or something. That's right.
There's a sense in which we typically, there's like a doctrine that stands behind, which is historical and true, and people have thought about it, but then it gets shifted and molded in different ways, and different emphases pop up, and then things start to get distorted. And it's just interesting to watch doctrines kind of develop and grow in that way.
So what I found was that whenever I would see that the human part of the Bible, it would be scandalous,
right?
And that would frustrate me. But then when we just kind of dove in and we're just like, let's look at this as literature, like you'd almost look at any piece of literature. Now, it's Jewish literature, so it has unique things from other types of literature. But let's look at it and unpack it. And what I found was, by approaching it in its humanity, the divinity really leaked out in new ways that were surprising and really exciting. That there's so much sophistication to the literary structure of the Bible, and then it just starts screaming of something more than just being merely human.
That human part of the Bible is the reason we do hermeneutics. It's why we do Bible study methods, things like that, right? Because if it were just a divine book dropped out of the sky, we wouldn't understand need to think about historical cultural context. We wouldn't need to think about literary genres or anything like
that. Right,
And it's interesting how all of that can be masked for us when you're reading the Bible in translation.
Yeah, right.
And you've only known it in one translation, because that itself, someone has already done an enormous amount of cultural homework.
That's right.
To make the Bible accessible to us in whatever language you happen to be reading it in. But that's that's like becomes a blind spot for us. We don't realize that's happened.
Yeah. It's been helpful as you, Tim, just watching your work, bringing up more of the original language to just kind of, I think, sometimes it's just to shake us out of kind of the biblish that we get into, or the Christianese that we get into. Just to kind of put a new word on it to help us rethink some of these things, and I find that really helpful.
So what John is processing right there is, so I didn't grow up reading the Bible, or being forced to read it or anything. So I'm like a 19, almost 20 when I start following Jesus, and it's brand new. Like, I maybe knew that there was somebody named Noah and Moses, but I couldn't tell you what order. I mean, I didn't know anything.
Yeah, right.
So it was fresh. And so, you know, within that first year, I'm signing up for classes and taking the Bible as literature at Multnomah. And
Bible study methods. To Christ and you go straight to Bible school.
Yeah, it's within the first year because I had all my other peers were taking classes there too.
Okay.
Nice. At the ministry, the skate park where I started following Jesus. So, I'm learning how to read it and reading it for the first time. And so Ray Lubeck was a professor there, but he was also really mediating the legacy of a towering Hebrew Bible scholar, John Salehammer, oh, yeah. Who taught it. Ted's and Bethel for many years. And
everywhere.
And everywhere. Yeah.
Even at Golden Western. Gate.
And
even
at Western.
For a couple
right.
years.
Well, yeah. that's yeah. exactly right. So, yeah. And essentially, it's a paradigm where it has an orthodox conviction about the human and divine inspiration of the scriptures. But that this is exquisitely crafted literature. Mm-hmm. It's a highly nuanced form of communication through the style of ancient Israelite and Second Temple Jewish scribes. And so that was my introduction. So I wouldn't even say it was a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
That just was
what
the paradigm.
Came into. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was a paradigm shift in that scholarly world.
Oh, so, for sure.
Yeah.
As I came to discover.
Yeah, yeah exactly. Yeah.
Because I didn't understand why. So right. I was introduced to the Book of Psalms
right.
as an intentionally structured canonical. Collection of 150. Yep. There's actually all these thematic arcs and design patterns.
Yeah.
And things that connect, and there's an argument. There's a theological argument
right.
that's advanced through the book. So that's how I learned to read this literature. And so so there you go. That's just how yeah. I've been. And to me, it was like all of a sudden, once I was given the skills and the tools to learn how to read it, it was just every day. Mm. I was just like, oh my gosh, I can't.
Yeah,
I'm actually hearing
yep.
a voice that's not my own here.
Right.
Somebody's talking to me here.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was my, I would call that like the literary paradigm, and that has been with me, and it's influenced
yeah.
The Bio Project and our conversations.
Yeah.
Were you guys into about. Literature beforehand? Like, did you
no.
like English literature, British literature, anything? No.
Okay. Comic book?
No, literature.
Oh, comic books, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
graphic novels.
Okay, no. Great.
For me, college was the first time I actually started reading books and writing down what I was learning from the books. I think that's supposed to start in high school.
There wasn't a natural affinity to literature, literary structure, anything behind that.
I am really drawn to story.
Yeah.
But I didn't study it.
Yeah.
And nor have I read a lot of good fiction. I didn't study in college. I will say that I've remarked a couple of times and over I think about this, how strange it is that as part of our spiritual tradition that we are students of a book. It feels strange to me because why a book? Why not? You know, you could be geeky about a lot of things, right? We could be really into botany, or we could really be into, it's Portland. You could be into homebrewing or yeah. all sorts of things. But to be nerdy about these ancient texts as part of our faith tradition, in order to understand ourselves in the world. Mm-hmm. It is a pretty niche kind of thing.
It is.
Studying literature isn't super niche. Mm. You know, literature is pretty important to the human condition. Mm-hmm. But ancient Jewish literature, it's a pretty niche topic.
And it's actually more unique. You read Larry Hurtado on this, where he talks about if you compare even ancient Near Eastern religions, as we call them, that Judaism itself was a very bookish, term, bookish religion.
Yeah.
So we take it for granted kind of in terms of like religion is centered around books.
Yeah.
That was actually a very Jewish Christian idea, which was really eye-opening to me because you just, you're in this culture and you just assume it and it's like, okay, this is what everybody does. They study literature, they study books. Mm-hmm. No, that was something that, I mean, I think there's a theology behind it in terms of word and communication.
Oh, yeah.
But just to see that was actually unique for that time and how the Christians were the ones who really took the codex rather than the scroll and ran with it. And it's just fascinating to think about.
Yeah,
yeah, we come from that tradition.
That's exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In fact, that for me became my next paradigm shift was I was just ravenously reading the Bible and just loving it and learning so much. And then again, in my peer group, I think one of my friends took Greek and he started telling us how incredible it was to be able to like read the Bible in Greek. And then I signed up for Greek with three more friends. And nice. Notice the pattern here. Yeah. We're all skateboarders.
Yeah.
And so then the whole issues of text criticism, canon formation, the manuscript history of the Bible. I discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, started reading Septuagint, comparing New Testament quotes to their Old Testament sources, and did the Pandora's box exploded on me. And that kind of set my next agenda for the next many, many years into dissertation research.
Right.
You did. But you're still probably taking Sailhammer.
Mm-hmm.
His,
yes.
His
Sailhammer gave me a framework to
that fit inspired all that. Editor.
Yes, type that's right.
Person.
Yeah. So that became really formative that we actually can know quite a bit about the formation processes of the biblical texts. This is not terrifying. It's actually thrilling, but it's very different than like the paradigm John was talking about that he grew up in. And
Moses wrote everything and then handed it to us.
Right. Right.
Well, God wrote it through Moses.
That's right. Moses just woke up one day and was like, what did I write? Just, You know, that kind of.
Including
that's
the
model.
Announcement of his death and how no one would find his body. And
correct.
That's
So, if I have had any kind of tension or crisis is too strong, but I really needed to work out for myself what it means, the model of inspiration of a divine words, speaking through texts that were formed, you know, and through a fairly complicated, long-term process.
Was that part of the impetus to do that, just kind of looking at the complexity of editors and compilation?
Some of that, and a lot of it just actually began, the Dead Sea Scrolls give us that window into the state of the biblical text a couple years before Jesus, the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
And it's complicated.
Yeah.
It's not simple.
Yeah.
And then I try to constantly just read parallel in New Testament text criticism and canon formation just because I felt like they illuminated each other. And it's the same thing. You know, those first couple centuries, the papyri, and then it's just complicated. The point is, those complications can be overcooked and oversold. Mm-hmm. As a figure like Bart Ehrman has made a lot of money overcooking.
Amazingly.
Yes, totally.
I always tell my students, I'm like, this guy took a very obscure...
Yeah.
I mean, I know we're into books, but still, he took a very... obscure thing that I think some people find difficult to teach on and made a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah.
Now, he twisted it, but it is.
Yeah, and he's got Jesus.
You know?
but the point is what he's putting his finger on is people who grow up in a tradition like what you experienced, John, are given no preparation.
Right.
Right.
And then you go into early Christianity, like 102 at university, and it's just the basic information about text criticism and manuscript history of the Bible, and it's shipwreck people's faith. Yes. They have no categories for how it all works together.
Yeah.
So that was just for me that the literary brilliance and genius of this literature, how it works, but then also the historical process of how it was formed. Mm. Those became really important categories for me, and they still inform in a big way how I even think about reading these texts and. Part of what we do through the Bible Project, we don't do a ton of that type of stuff.
Though you want to do
something. Is the historical part still, I mean, you guys have videos on making of the Bible?
Nope.
No?
We're talking about
Do you have a video on text criticism? I'm sure that'll get millions of views.
Right? no, we don't really.
We have one on the formation of the Tanakh as a collection of scrolls. We're toying with some projects that would invite people into that on a popular audience.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That'd be helpful.
Because it's not terrifying. Yeah. There's nothing scandal.
No. Right.
There's
it's not magical scandalous. Or anything like
no,
that.
No. Yeah. It's really actually amazing.
Yeah.
Right.
There's no skeletons, really. It's just it's just a process.
Correct. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, so.
Yeah. Well, this has been good. Let's take a little break and then we'll come back and hear some more.
Yeah, deal.
My name's Aram, and I'm in the MABTS program at Western Seminary. My favorite part about this program is that I get to study and reflect on God's Word at an academic level, and I also get to learn around some amazing people. The students and faculty here have helped me grow in the way I understand God and His Word, and I also get to do it in an environment that pushes and challenges me both personally and academically. Western Seminary offers a number of programs to help students prepare for the work God has called them to through rigorous education designed with practical application. If you're interested in learning more about Western or starting your application, visit us online at westernseminary.edu. Now back to the show.
All right, well, welcome back. We are here with Tim and John from the Bible Project, and this is Food Trucks in Babylon. We like to ask what your favorite food trucks are lately or maybe all time, whichever one. John, do you have one here in the Portland area?
Yeah, there's a Korean fried chicken place, cart on 28th and Burnside, that little pod there.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember the name. Shoot, it's a cool name.
It is.
Not Kim Jong Grillin.
No.
Yeah, that's a great name too.
Oh, it's... What's the term when fear of missing out? FOMO. It's called FOMO.
Oh, it's called FOMO.
It is. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. It is excellent.
It's really good.
I'm old enough. I had to look that up at one point.
Yeah, totally.
Somebody was like FOMO on Instagram. I'm like, I have no idea what that means.
Yeah.
I have to do that all the time.
Jesus. Constantly. Urban Dictionary.
We're getting old.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
That's right. What about you, Tim?
Let's see. You know, a regular on the lunch circuit that John and I walk to a lot, I really enjoy a Sherpa Kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
It's like Himalayan style noodle dishes. Mm-hmm. So nice. Good. They give you like warm chai tea to drink while you're waiting in the cold. and then Kim Jong Grillin is.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Unbelievable. Yeah. These bowls will blow your mind.
Yep. I love it.
Holy cow. There you go. Those are my two tops.
Thanks. So we were talking about just like paradigm shifts, how you became who you are and how that's. Mm. Makes its way into the work that you do. And we left off with some text criticism, which is an odd sort of, you know, it's like, well, I went through this period where I was thinking about text criticism and formation of scriptures, but it does have a huge effect on how you read the Bible, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's about what fills your imagination when you think of how these biblical texts were actually produced and written and composed. Most people have some kind of scenario they're filling in their mind. And the question is that how it actually happened?
Yeah.
So that's more. And I find the understanding how the texts were actually produced, text production in the ancient world and preservation really illuminates how the expectations put on the reader of how to make sense of them. They kind of go hand in hand with literary design. But I think John...
Yeah, so that ways. And that tees up the literary design is the second paradigm shift. So it's very connected. The first one being it's both human and divine. And by looking at its humanity, I actually see its divinity more clearly. That was a big shift for me. So then what does that mean to look at its humanity? And one of the things, one of the tools that Tim has equipped me with and people who watch the videos is looking at the literary design of books. And now also we're talking more and more about the literary design of smaller literary units than an entire scroll, whether it be a chapter or what we call chapters, but that there is a high degree of sophistication in how these things are designed, and that through its design, we can then get to what did the author intend to communicate. Mm-hmm. And they do that through repeated words. They do that through plot and characters and these kind of recurring motifs, kind of it's just a lot of riffing. If you think of like jazz or something, there's just a lot of like picking up on a melody,
right?
And you're supposed to just know and see it. I never would. In fact, if I did see it, it would just feel repetitive, almost like it was a mistake. Like you already told me that.
Or else they couldn't think of anything else to say. Or they have a limited vocabulary, something like that.
But
it turns out these are like really good writers.
Amazingly sophisticated writers. Pushing the boundaries of what they could do with the technology of a scroll. And communicating a really grand narrative. And that was wonderful. And it still is increasingly so wonderful to see.
I want to bring up Hurtado again, second time. But he talks about how when they crafted these, that there probably was multiple drafts and edits and things like that, just because of the production was so difficult in one way, which would make you think maybe they just did one draft and done. But because they were so important, that there's some evidence that these, I'm especially thinking of Paul's epistles right now,
yeah,
but
yeah.
be dictated and then read over and then honed and then
yes.
talked about more and then
yes.
sent off after like a lot of care and thought. And that just,
you'd have to imagine.
Yeah. That's just kind of
yeah.
getting, I mean, back to your idea, kind of getting behind the text a little bit to understand the production
yeah,
was really helpful for me to see in terms of, yeah, there's a lot of care that goes into themes and language and mm-hmm. word plays. Mm-hmm. I mean, man, if you start digging into the language,
mm-hmm. yeah.
sometimes you begin to see word plays that are just yes. blowing your mind.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing.
It's, yeah.
Yeah.
The, yeah, that's actually kind of a new horizon for me in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
The degree of word play, puns.
Yep.
That's the technical term is paranomasia.
Oh,
nice. But it's whole paragraphs will be organized around like the repetition of a few
right.
sounds or consonants.
Yep.
And but it's not weird like Bible numerological code. It's just yeah. like really beautiful literary yeah. communication.
Yep. Yeah, it's what you expect when yeah. you think of what you could do with language in terms of communication.
That's
you know,
right.
Through yeah. rhyming and
that's right.
And it's not the way we do it in English.
Right.
It's a different
yeah.
way to do it.
One probably for me the forefront of kind of my own research when I'm excited about is the way that literary patterns, repeated words start creating. We call them design patterns. Mm-hmm. Different scholars have different names for them, but what we were just talking about pressing the technology boundary.
Mm-hmm.
So the. Just the Hebrew Bible, it's a collection of independent scrolls. It never existed in one codex in the Second Temple period. So it's a collection of separate scrolls, mm-hmm. but they are all cross-referencing each other and quoting and linking each other through these patterns in a way that it becomes very clear that over time, the scribes, who I believe the Holy Spirit was guiding to produce all of this, actually viewed all of it as one thing in their minds.
Mm. Yeah.
But there wasn't a technology available for it all.
With a particular order, a scroll order, perhaps? Is that as big a deal?
The scroll order, for sure, from Genesis to 2 Kings, which okay. is one narrative sequence. And then the rest of the books of, and then the books of the prophets yes. all begin with the first sentence is just one big, like if we were on a web page, it'd be a hyperlink back to some moment yep. in that narrative sequence.
Okay.
And then once you get to like Psalms or Ruth, you just need a couple little cues to hyperlink it into the collection, and then you're off to the races, just working the patterns and the melodies. And so it's one whole thing in the minds of these authors, but it couldn't be contained in any one place.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's become really fascinating to me, the way a collection of scrolls can be unified, hyperlinks and patterns.
Even in the way that you have, the way that you've shown how they're viewing it and the way they hyperlink, you can't even really show that in a codex. It's, there's so much layering of ideas.
You need Wikipedia for that.
So actually,
you would need a type of Wikipedia type thing
right.
yeah.
that would start to draw that out.
So, an excellent illustration. Your recent book on Matthew, which I've only been able to peruse, but it's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
You're in the Gospels, and you've got Jesus getting baptized, going through the wilderness, up to a mountain where he starts expositing the Ten Commandments.
Yep.
And saying how the whole Torah is about
that's
him.
Right. It's all...
And so what he's doing, that's the end process.
Mm-hmm.
Patterns, Moses patterns like that,
yep.
through the waters, wilderness, 40 days, 40 years. That already has been happening within the Hebrew Bible itself.
It's not a novel thing to the Gospels.
Right. That's right.
Right.
And so the New Testament authors are so into this
mm-hmm.
that they don't even have to explicitly draw attention to it. They just assume that if you have been reading these texts, you've been trained to read them.
Yeah, right.
Because you have been brought into the Christian community.
That story.
And where you're learning how to read them. And like Pesher or Midrash or those sorts of things.
I think so. There's an immense amount of confusion around how Jews in the Second Temple period read and understood and interpreted their Bible. And my deep hunch is that it's Western scholars trying to get our minds around what was native to these people who lived and grew up on these texts.
Yeah.
And so we sometimes see it as, when Paul will quote from, you know, a redeemer will come out of Zion. No mm-hmm. quote from, you know, a psalm or something, or from Isaiah 59. But actually, he's bridging three different texts from the Hebrew Bible in his mind. He's blending the word together. And if you go back in the Hebrew Bible, they themselves are hyperlinked to each other mm-hmm. through some patterning or connection. And they know exactly what they're doing. And they are tracking with patterns that are already there. But because, different traditions that people happen to be brought up in, we're just not trained to read the Bible that way. And so it looks arbitrary.
But we are trained, I think, culturally to view media that way.
Oh.
So when I think of film and my favorite movies and my favorite directors and what makes a film work,
right.
as soon as you start getting geeky about it, you're thinking about
that's true.
The same types of ideas.
That's true.
Of what you're...
Yeah,
of plots and
motifs.
Compositions and motifs, yeah, and
that's right.
And then you have it's a different medium; it's a visual medium, mm-hmm. but it's the same kind of mm-hmm. things yeah. are at play.
You know, I'm not a music theory scholar at all, but I've been doing a little reading on Beethoven scholars, mm-hmm. and actually, this was his thing. He invented
the Beethoven Project is next.
Yeah, the Beethoven yeah. Project, but apparently, like he invented mechanisms to unify whole symphonies around just a few chords
okay.
or a few melodies that he would introduce in the first 60 seconds and then so it's interesting to me that it's actually in art
yeah.
that you find very close analogies to yeah. biblical style.
Yeah. Jordan, do you know that name?
He's absolutely.
Peter Lightheart.
Correct. Yeah.
They and Alistair Roberts,
yes.
they've used a lot of they've used some,
yeah.
probably not a lot of music theory to help train people to interpret the Bible.
Yeah, it's very...
That's all I have to say about that. I don't know yeah, where else they went with that.
Yeah, but, I'm just kind of beginning yeah. to think about how fruitful yeah. the analogy can be.
But, so now the question would be, there's some people who look at the way the apostles read the Old Testament, and they would say, because they'd been trained in that, just as a way of life, we are not. So... there, that apostolic reading is not available to us other than what they wrote. We can't read the Bible the same way. But I take it you don't agree with that. That seems to be a big part of what the Bible Project's trying to do.
Yeah.
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 No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I think there's a couple versions of that. One is that some people have the view that they actually are inspired by the Spirit. The apostles are inspired by the Spirit to discover meaning that was hidden
yeah.
and unknowable there.
Like little Easter eggs throughout the Old Testament.
But there, you know, once you see it, you can't go back, and it's right there. I think I'm trying to help uncover a little bit different than that. Because somebody like Simeon, in the Gospel of Luke, somebody like Simeon, who's awaiting the redemption of Jerusalem, and what the Holy Spirit told him was, you're going to see the person before you die. The Holy Spirit apparently didn't have to tell him, there's going to be a person, and here's why, you're waiting for him. Like, he knew all that. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how did he know to be anticipating someone in whom the redemption of Jerusalem would come about? And that's what I'm after. How did someone like Simeon grow up reading the Hebrew Scriptures? Which he almost certainly didn't. He didn't have them in a book. He heard them and probably had most of it memorized, and he had it in his heart. In his mind, as one big thing.
Another way we talk about this.
That's kind of, and I think, we should recover that as much as we can.
Yeah.
One way you've talked about this is as it's Jewish meditation literature.
Yeah, yeah. Psalm 1.
Psalm 1.
Right. Yeah.
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 And
day and night. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it seems like you're pushing towards human author. Not at the expense of the divine author.
Correct.
But that you're pushing into... these authors know what they're doing. So sometimes I'm not fishing here. I'm just wondering.
Yeah, yeah.
It almost seems so genius sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When do you think? I know there's this intermarriage, right?
Yeah,
of the human
right.
divine author.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
sometimes I struggle with like, is this the divine author coming in and just kind of directing? But I don't want to have that view of just kind of like forcing. Okay, write this word.
Yeah.
How much like?
Yeah.
Sometimes that intermarriage is difficult for me to.
Yeah.
You have any thoughts on that in terms of
like some sort of biblical Apollinarianism where the divine overwhelms the human?
Oh wow!
Right.
No, I'm not. Yeah. I'm not getting there. But you know what I mean? Like,
no, I'm with you.
There's
I have
a sense in which it's so amazing sometimes that I'm like,
I know it.
What is it, the human, like, do you have any thoughts about human relationship, human divine author on that?
Other than just my brain explodes on a regular basis, right, reading the Hebrew, right, Bible. And the same. It's actually through thinking about Jewish meditation literature and ancient text production that, yeah, I feel like I meet the voice and presence of the Spirit, mm-hmm, in these texts.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it all points me to Jesus,
yeah,
on a regular basis. And that's just been my experience.
Right.
So,
right, yeah,
it's actually focusing on,
yeah,
these literary strategies, mm-hmm, and ancient cultural styles of communication that gets, yeah, for me, it's the gateway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I know until somebody can get more native to the Bible and how it works, it sounds a little crazy. Or it sounds like, you know,
right,
like you want to fill it out theoretically. But mm-hmm, I think what I have found, especially with students, is once you can just get them into the story,
yeah,
they can see how it works, yeah, and then they start having their own,
yeah, yeah,
discoveries,
yeah,
of how it all works together. And then you can just, yeah, let the Bible do its work,
exactly,
on people.
Yeah. Yeah.
We just filmed an intro to the Hebrew Bible class.
Yeah.
And so we had 6 students that Tim walked through a lot of the stuff with. And you can see the discomfort at first and the kind of just bewilderment. Mm-hmm. And then once you started reading through
actual
texts,
yeah,
just minds being blown and just this, yeah, awe and just excitement. It's just, yeah, raw energy, yeah, of, yeah, just like, oh my goodness, this is my Bible.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's,
and
right,
you just saw that happen, yeah, in real time. It was, yeah, cool.
It is cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, any other paradigm shifts that you had? I know you have more.
the third one we like to talk about is that the Bible is a cosmic drama. It's one cosmic story that Jesus sees himself as fulfilling. So it's unified story leads to Jesus, is kind of our tagline at the Bible Project.
By cosmic, what do you mean?
Mm-hmm. The entire universe.
Universe, yeah.
Yeah.
Cosmos.
Of the heavens and the earth.
Yeah.
And what God is doing, mm-hmm, in the universe, specifically through humanity, these dirt creatures, mm-hmm, that he has given his image to, that whole drama. That then gets, you know, specifically about the family of Abraham, but Jesus sees himself as being the fulfillment of that. And so, and what we don't mean by that is you can go back into any story and then find, oh, this is talking about Jesus and this is talking about Jesus, but that all of these themes and motifs and ideas and the whole plot of the Hebrew scriptures is all finds its climax and resolution in Jesus and new creation. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's kind of a structural paradigm for us.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like the other two kind of lead towards that one in some sense, right? Foundation, mm-hmm, for,
yeah, that's right,
reading it as, yeah, kind of that unified drama.
Yeah.
Cosmic drama.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not your average, like, story.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, right, you don't just go from Genesis to Revelation,
no,
and, yep, it's a single, yep, you know, like the classic plot arc.
Yep.
It's cycling.
Right.
It's like a symphony. Right. More like a symphony.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the time you get to the end, you're overwhelmed because you've actually gone through, right, a climax resolution about 200 times.
Yeah. You know, did you listen to that on script podcast about the Bible as poetry or something? Do you remember that one? I don't remember who it was.
You know, I'm behind on script, okay, right now.
Okay.
I'm behind.
There was
on
one that was really interesting right where he was just pushing against the narrative.
Interesting.
And saying, yeah, it's poetry.
And
trying, he actually,
yeah,
I think he was trying to be
poetic or poet.
Poetry. Yeah, I guess poetic.
I see, got it.
He thinks it makes more sense to view it as, yeah, almost a large, yeah, I don't remember, maybe a poem.
Yeah.
But I think what he was trying to do, he was pushing, felt like he was pushing too hard. He was just saying you see different things if you put kind of that,
yeah,
poetic,
yeah,
lens over it that you won't see if you just do narrative.
One shortcoming of trying to summarize the storyline of the Bible in like 5 things, yep, is just that.
Yep.
So you go, you know, from creation, fall.
Yep. Yep.
Hopefully, yes, you have an Abraham or Israel movement in there, yeah, maybe an exile. But then you're off to the prophets and the new,
yep,
creation. You're like, but what happened to the wisdom literature?
Right, right, right. Yep.
And what happened to Ezra and Nehemiah?
That's right.
And like, those,
yep,
are really important,
yep,
contributions.
Yeah.
And so it's much more, Scott McKnight uses the phrase wiki stories. Mm. So like the Book of Ruth is like almost a mini reenactment of the whole drama in a one little mini story.
Yeah.
And it's more like that.
Yep.
A collection of wiki stories.
Biblical theology, I mean, term in the realm we're in, biblical theology, kind of narrative scripture.
Yes.
I always tell my students it's really fun to do, but it's also dangerous in one sense because you're kind of choosing, hopefully you're letting the biblical authors choose, but you're also choosing which themes to highlight and which themes not to highlight in certain retellings.
That's right.
Yeah, that's what we do.
But it's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. Yeah.
Sometimes different biblical theologies will run into one another.
Yeah.
And
those are the hardest videos for us to write, too, when we try to isolate one theme.
Yep.
It's helpful to just isolate
a theme. It is. And you can do it. And you see the scriptural authors, I think, doing it. But there's a complexity there as well, and a paradox to scripture that you...
And you can kill the butterfly.
That's right. Easily.
Agreed.
Probably the question that we get the most about Bible Project and what we thought of what was written was the Gospel Coalition's critique of your atonement. How have you thought through that?
Yeah, I gave a lot. Richard, he's a pastor in I forget what city in Australia.
Australia, yeah.
Yeah. There were a few pieces to it. One was it was a thoughtful essay. He had gone through a number of my old sermons that were relevant, two in particular that were done quite a few years ago. And he had excerpted some quotes.
This from your time, like, in Wisconsin?
When I was in Wisconsin, and then one was pastor in Portland. And so, you know, sermons, I tend more towards lecture-style sermons. That's just kind of my style. I think it maybe is a weak point in whatever. That's more my style. But in both of those messages, one that he quoted from, I had noticed a pattern in both churches I was a part of. And it was a really distorted view of the Trinity that Jesus is saving us from God.
Yeah.
He saves us from God.
From God or like
from the Father.
God the Father in particular.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Okay. That's right. And I'll never forget a woman like
wrathful God and loving Jesus.
Correct. So this woman was sitting on my couch in a small group one night, and she's, you know, portraying her Bible in two parts, and there's the God hates me part, and then there's the Jesus saves me from the God who wants to kill me. And I can't tell you what a constant drumbeat this was in both churches that I was a part of. So those were the context into which I gave sermons about the meaning of Jesus' death and the relationship of God's justice and his mercy, and I thought they were balanced. I think Richard disagreed. But then he went and was surveying different Bible Project videos.
Yes.
And that's fine. But it's true, like in our Romans 1-4 video, my portrayal, and continue to be really struck by the depiction of God's wrath, Romans 1:16-17, the wrath of God is revealed against all who suppress the truth and righteousness.
So you do believe in the wrath of God?
Well, yes.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to give you the chance to say it right there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know how you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
God's angry at what humans have done to each other and to his world. The question is, what is he doing with that anger?
Yeah.
And how does he express it? And Paul expresses it in Romans 1-4 through the triple repeated, and he handed them over. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was cluing into the video. So we depict humans entrapping themselves, God allowing people to trap themselves, and so we show humans in chains to death and sin. And Richard felt like we should have used the actual language of God's wrath, handing people over to their sin. Mm-hmm. And then he went through some other videos, like in the prophets, and he noticed the absence or what he thought was the downplaying of wrath language in some places. And I don't like one in the book of Nahum. He noted wrath, the vocabulary of wrath appears a lot in Nahum 1. And I didn't use the word, but the whole picture was like the king of Assyria's head getting exploded by a bolt of divine lightning. Mm. But I don't know.
So picture has a thousand
so
words.
Yeah. So I think the substance of his argument, what he was nervous was that we were essentially saying that the death of Jesus had nothing to do with God's judgment on human sin. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I do think the mosaic imagery, like the cross as like the gem, the multifaceted mm-hmm. gem, the apostles are not bound mm-hmm. to one language scheme when they talk about the cross. But at the heart of it is someone being in our place on our behalf.
So do you think it was a misunderstanding or difference of interpretation or a little bit of both?
I think a little bit of both. Okay, I think a little bit of both. Yeah. And I actually... I went and talked with quite a few friends about the article, and I can see patterns in my own thinking where I will strategically delay language about divine anger until we've covered some other things about the cross. And I know that there are traditions where divine anger needs to be the foregrounded element when you're talking about the cross, the central element even. Mm. So I think that would be an area of difference.
Yeah, right.
And just to say, that's an area of difference because I don't see that pattern in the apostles themselves. Mm-hmm. And actually, I've gone through many times just to make sure I'm not messing this up, but there is not one text in the New Testament where the cross, where the divine attribute of wrath is directly connected in the same sentence as to the meaning of the cross. In other words, the number one divine attribute mm-hmm. highlighted in the New Testament's depiction of this cross is agape. Mm-hmm. Now, wrath fits into a larger narrative about why Jesus needed to die. But to me, it's significant that when the apostles talk about the meaning of the cross, the divine attribute they foreground is God's agape love, not at the expense of his justice.
That's right.
But if they want to make sure you remember something about the meaning of the cross, they want you to walk away with agape. Yeah. So maybe that's the difference of interpretation. Yeah. I don't know. I'm actually curious how you guys process that.
Well, I think that there's that. I would just to maybe repeat what you just said, that there is a background of God's anger at sin.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so why the cross? It is certainly a demonstration of God's holiness, but it's motivated by his love.
That's right.
The easiest way for God just to pour out wrath would be for him to pour out wrath.
Yeah.
And yet he does something substitutionary for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And it is certainly motivated by love.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm learning mm-hmm. and I wanna represent the apostles the way they want to represent themselves. Yeah. And so that's something that we all are on a journey of learning to try and do.
I taught 1 Peter last semester, two semesters ago. Mm. Just looking at some of the Christological paradigms he does, I was struck that he takes that substitute language, I don't think he brings up the wrath language actually at all. Mm-mm. But he brings the substitute. Jesus is kind of the ultimate slave actually who suffers. Mm-hmm. And then that provides the example. But he's also the substitute. And then later on he'll bring up in a very confusing text, but kind of the Christus Victor. Mm. So in one kind of section of 1 Peter, you have at least three of the models of the atonement in terms of substitute, moral example, and then he declares victory as he goes down.
And the lamb, he talks about the blood of the lamb
in
chapter 1.
So
that's a good example. He's got a full palette of images to
and
talk about the cross.
He uses all of them in different ways and can go in and out of them. Yeah. I think sometimes we want to have kind of this neat little package of you can only talk about this one here and there, but it seems like all of them inform one another.
Yeah.
Kind of that kaleidoscopic view.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. The text I was thinking about, it's a difficult text, Romans 3:25, that God presented him as a hysterion.
Yeah.
Right? The atoning sacrifice, or some old translations would go between propitiation or expiation.
Yes. Or the very old interpretation that is getting more champions recently is the covenant, the lid of the, he is the place in which sins are dealt with.
Right.
The mercy seat.
The mercy seat. Yeah. That was the other one I was going to bring up.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
As you interpret that verse, just, you have any thoughts about that in terms of what is that, if you take it as atoning sacrifice, Is there a wrath kind of idea in there? First mercy seat.
Oh man.
You know, I don't have actually a pat answer for that either. So I'm kind of fishing here, but
you know, actually I've become really convinced that the place we ought to go, and where Paul is explicitly working out the divine attributes in relation to the cross, is Romans 8, 1 through 4, where he talks about God condemning sin. By giving up his son as a sin offering so that he might condemn sin in the flesh of Jesus.
Right.
But his language there is not quite like, again, the language of like this woman sitting on my couch who would tell me about a song about Jesus bearing the wrath of the Father. And it seems to me Paul would say, no, sin is being condemned by God's anger there. Paul doesn't mention God's wrath, but it's interesting. He talks about sin is the object of God's judgment.
Yeah.
So at the cross, Christ, we're told by Paul, becomes sin, right?
He
knew no sin became sin on our behalf.
Right. That's my question, though. What's the relationship between Christ becoming sin? You know what I mean?
We're still a far cry from language about Jesus bearing the anger of God. There actually isn't a biblical text
Was God angry at Jesus as he was dying?
Paul says very clearly, and when he activates the Abraham and Isaac story in Romans 8, that he did not withhold his only son as an act of agape love. And that's just what I'm more concerned about is I want to imitate the language of the apostles and what they are trying to get across, but also what people hear.
Yeah.
What people hear is important to me.
Right. And there's a systematic side to this, too, that you have to be careful with.
Yeah.
The Father and the Son becoming separate.
Oh, sure. Yes. That is
very dangerous, even when people talk about
Todd, you probably know a lot more about that.
The forsakenness.
Yes.
On the cross of Jesus. Yeah. You have to be really careful, like, that God, the Father is just like, okay, I'm completely apart from you. Then you're up a creek in terms of Trinitarian doctrine and the unity of the Father, Son, and the Spirit.
Correct.
Now, there's different economies.
All of the divine actions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's another piece that you have to throw in to make it more complicated.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's right.
But a nice boundary, though, for our discussion.
That's right.
Because we can't... The Father, the Son, and the Spirit are different persons, whatever exactly that means, right? There's a continuity of action, right?
That's right.
There is one being there. God took care of sin at the cross. We're not saying that the Father died, right? We can't use that language because it was the Son who died, but it was not God against God against God. So to speak, it was God dealing with sin in its fullness and totality.
Agreed. Agreed. However, different traditions, church traditions, have developed in, highlighting, foregrounding different things, and I still continue to be amazed at how the apostles can't find enough different ways to talk about the meaning of the cross.
Yeah.
And in ways that were shocking, and I think still are, as the ultimate act of exaltation and glory and honor or love, things that would have struck no one who was standing there watching Jesus die. It was apocalyptic in that sense,
Well, you guys have done a great job of kind of avoiding, I don't know how to put this, but kind of walking with the scriptures and not trying to bring a lot of tradition into it. Now, obviously, you have to bring some tradition into it, but just in terms of debates, been very impressed with how you've walked through different tough issues. I mean, the millennial issue, everyone is interested
that.
In how you
haven't
do that.
Seen that Calvinist versus Arminian.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Bible which Project video.
Good, though. Yeah. I appreciate that because it kind of unifies people around the Bible, which
I think so
honestly
too.
Would part of what we're doing here at Western and one of our values as well. And just to see people come around the Bible from different traditions and say, like, we value this as the scriptures. So that's been really great and helpful. Appreciate you all doing that.
Yeah. A lot of that comes from Tim Spurgeon, I think. And your desire to find unity and to allow people from different spectrums,
right?
Kind of see where they agree, and then even feel like, well, if we, you know, you can teach through a book, and you can have an Arminian going like, yep, and that's why I believe,
that's right,
the way I believe, and then a Calvinist doing the exact same thing,
exactly.
Yeah, for me, that's the win.
That's the win.
So everybody looks and is like, exactly.
Which is actually, and it's really remarkable how that can be done. And we have had very little pushback for some reason, penal substitutionary atonement as being a hot issue. And I don't know exactly why. I think one of my hunches is that, and it's from my church tradition, my spiritual tradition, that you kind of, the whole point is to know the right things to then go to the right place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if that's the paradigm, then what's the central right thing to believe? And the central right thing to believe in that tradition is that God dealt with my sin on the cross.
Right.
And so you have to know it exactly right.
Yeah.
And
there's kind of,
don't get the wrath thing wrong.
We had a discussion about gospel, I think, right before you guys like published yours with N.T. Wright. With N.T. Wright. But I think it's linked, penal substitution is linked to, sometimes we narrow the gospel language, euangelion, to that point.
Yep, that's what we mean.
Yeah. So then if someone thinks you're neglecting that point, then are you neglecting the gospel?
And then the whole thing's falling apart.
But it comes back to how do you, what is the gospel? Yeah. How do the gospels define the gospel? How does the Old Testament, how does Isaiah, so forth and so on?
Yeah.
Well, we really appreciate you guys coming by.
Yeah, totally.
Thanks for doing this with us. We'll have to do it again.
That was really
if we can ever get you up here again, we'll see if we can. But
awesome.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, totally. Yes. Yeah, thank you. We enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Food Trucks in Babylon. The music you hear is provided by our friends at Humble Beast Records. If you like the show, please leave us a review and feel free to subscribe. To learn more about Western Seminary, visit us at westernseminary.edu.